Well, I think we'll make a start. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our Super Policy Forum session on new ideas for age pension reform by Mr. Dunsford and Mr. Whipham. I'm just going to very quickly introduce our two speakers. I think Geoff is going to run through a little bit about the format as to how they want to conduct the meeting tonight. And my job will really just be to sit over there, look pretty, and just maybe play policeman if there's too much heated discussion. But otherwise, that'll be sort of my role. Our two presenters tonight are Geoff Dunsford and Darren Whipham. Geoff is on my immediate left. Geoff's had a long career in life insurance and superannuation, working with a number of life companies and consultancies. He's encompassed management roles, actuarial roles, both in Australia and the UK. His last full-time role was as chief actuary at MLC, and then followed 3 years in a couple of consultancies with Tillinghast and Rice Walker. Geoff has written a number of papers, and one of which includes Retirement Incomes Integration, Superannuation Tax and Social Security, which he did with Michael Rice in 2004. And another paper in 2005 called A New Superannuation Model? Darren is an actuary who works with in superannuation as a principal with Mercer, Mercer Retirement Risk and Financial Practice. He advises on strategic matters including product design and financial risk management for large superannuation funds and also on general superannuation matters for employers. Darren currently chairs the Institute's Benefit Projection Working Group, which has received quite a bit of publicity in the last little while around providing a lot of input into government considerations and discussing matters with Nick Sherry around some of the latest developments on benefit projections for superannuation fund members. He's also more recently been awarded the Institute's Melville Prize for the best paper presented at our biennial convention for It's Time to Abolish Retirement, which I remember had a mixed reaction of enthusiasm and some older members saying, no, I don't think that's quite that time yet. Both Darren and Geoff have had quite a long standing interest in retirement income policy, and apart from the papers I just mentioned a minute ago, they were both also on our tax reform task force in 2006, which was chaired by a gentleman by the name of John Trowbridge, who you might know of, with some other members, Cathy Nance and Pauline Durant, who I saw in the audience, who were responsible for producing, I think, 8 submissions to Peter Costello's Peter Costello and Treasury on Mr. Costello's Better Super proposals in 2006. And we understand those proposals were very highly regarded by Treasury when they received them. Well, that was the feedback I received anyway. Now, I choose to read it in that they were highly regarded. I didn't actually introduce myself, by the way. I'm Greg Martin, the president of the Institute of Actuaries. But, I sort of I know most people in the audience, so I should have, sorry, it was my apologies for doing that. Now, the only other thing is, of course, you've got your mobile phones all turned off, I'm sure. And with no much more further ado, I'll hand over to Geoff, I think, is that right? He's going to kick off. So, thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to New Ideas for Age Pension Reform. Now, we've distributed a discussion paper reviewing age pension structure and the costs going into the future. We note various problems and we suggest various solutions. Now it's quite a different paper from that which was produced by the Retirement Incomes Task Force, which has been sort of manipulated around and made into a submission which the Institute of Actuaries will be making to the pension review. Our paper is quite different. We had in fact Darren and I have been working on something of this nature for some time, and so we'll be putting forward our own thoughts quite separately. In fact, the Henry review actually is quite timely because since we started the paper before the announcement, it made the paper that much more relevant, which is very pleasing for us. Now, in Australia, we have the what are considered very desirable three-pillar policy for retirement incomes. However, the pillars are not integrated. And that causes a few problems. We have inadequate focus on retirement incomes, lots of focus on lump sums. We have super benefits, which are very risky, more risky because they're invested in risky investments. We have messy regulation and administration, continuous means testing, and a complex superannuation tax system, which distorts equity between the various members. A major review is thus overdue, and if only because the cost of age pensions is increasing. 2.9% of GDP, according to the intergenerational report last year, rising to 4.4% of GDP in 40 years' time. And as you may have read in the paper, that some of the modelling had been done the way we thought it should be done, the figure is more like 4.8% of GDP. What the government didn't do was to increase means test thresholds in line with increases in the age pension. One would have thought they would have done that, and they didn't, so we made some adjustments, and we think 4.8%, which of course makes the problem of future costs for future for the next generation even more a serious problem. Now, there are lots of issues and possible solutions. Not all of the solutions, of course, are covered in the, not all of the problems and solutions are covered in the paper. We want to hear from you. For each section, we are intending to have a three-minute presentation, and then it'll be over to you. But we've only got about 10 minutes for each section, so we'd like you to keep your comments short and to the point, if you could, please. Now I'll hand over to Darren to talk about the first section.
Thanks, Jeff, and I'd like to take the opportunity to say that Jeff's been the driving force behind this paper and has generated most of the ideas, and while I'm named as a co-author, certainly Jeff deserves the more substantial credit for the paper. As I said, we're quite interested in your feedback, and like the microphone is. And we actually have a questionnaire which we'd like to distribute. It's anonymous, and we're going to compile the results and publish them in ACRI Australia, so we might hand those out there as we go. So we'd like to have, first of all, a brief discussion about the purpose of the age pension. And the purpose of the age pension is important because it influences the direction of your reform. Now, when Social Security age pensions were first debated in Europe in the 1800s, the main focus was alleviating old age poverty, mainly because people were unable to work because of disability. Now, certainly, the alleviation of poverty has been the main focus in Australia, with our means-tested pension ensuring that the pension goes to those most in need. And the age pension has a secondary purpose. It also serves as one of the pillars in our three pillars, or as the World Bank now thinks, five pillars, retirement income policy. And for most people, it's actually the largest part of their retirement income. But from the very outset of the age pension in Australia, there has been some confusion about its purpose. And this confusion is actually evident in the preamble to the first age pension legislation in 1900 in New South Wales. And I think this statement sums up the confusion perfectly. I've paid my taxes, I've earned the age pension. Now that's actually not true. It's not true because currently the age pension is means tested, so not everyone gets it. But there's this conflict, there's this misperception out there. So what is the purpose of the age pension? What's it going to be in the future? People are becoming healthier in their old age. More and more people are receiving the age pension who are actually capable of work, they're not disabled or anything. So by default, are we moving away from this targeting of need because we're giving the age pension to people that are capable of work? So, throw it over to yourself. What is the purpose of the age pension? What do you think it should be? Any questions? Any comments?
G'day, my name's Alex Dunham from Planet Standard. I also write
for a publication in Canberra, and what's been really interesting about this whole debate.
Can we turn the feedback down or something?
It's
like being at a rock concert, testing one, chew, chew. But anyway, this whole issue is really, really topical. I wrote a piece about a month ago picking up the point you're saying these are baby boomers, they own all the houses, they own all the shares, they own all the super, and now they want more pensions. And I did it in response to some things that Robert Bauman from Vanguard was saying in terms of there's a bit of a divide happening now between Gen Y and the boomers. It's a really vitriolic issue. I had letters to the editor pouring in, people wanting me to be hung, drawn and quartered in Garema Place. It was this huge fun, but there were a lot of really, really upset pensioners in Canberra. So it was a fantastic article from my point of view, but they really believe exactly what you say. I've done my time, I've paid my taxes, it's now paid up. And a lot of things you're saying, you're going to be shot dead on the street when you walk out the door here. And it's a really tough political issue for all the reasons you said. So I absolutely endorse what you're saying.
There's probably another word, Teresa Cott, there's probably another word in there, not I've earned, but I've earned the right to an age pension. There's another argument, and not only for the alleviation of poverty, but self-funded retirees, and I'm going to speak from a select group, believe that with a little bit of help from the government, you delay the self-funded retiree picking up the age pension to a later date. So a little bit invested now pays off dividends in the long term.
Darren, I'm a recent immigrant, well, not that recent immigrant to the country, but and you're much younger than me. I thought that post-war there had actually been a contribution to a fund which got consolidated into tax. So that statement is, there are people who actually, for whom that is true.
Yes.
And a lot of them are retired.
Post-war, I think it was the Chifley government to fund some of its expenditure, set up the National Welfare Fund. And this was a notional fund that received tax contributions and essentially it was a mechanism to raise taxes for people. But there was never any promise of a universal pension that went with it. It was simply a tax increase that washed through this fund. The fund was actually, I think, wound up in the 1980s, and it used to be, it ended up as simply an accounting mechanism, so it stayed around for a long time. But for about 3 or 4 years, people did have a hypothecated tax to fund Social Security. So that's a good point.
Jeff Burgess. My personal view is that we should be aiming to provide a level of support for people who are retired, whatever their age may be, that allows them to have a reasonable standard of living. It doesn't have to be they don't have to have a lot of money, but more than just avoiding real poverty. Having said that, it doesn't all have to come from the age pension. Now, the age pension, as you've mentioned, is only one component of the financial resources available to people in retirement. For some people it is probably the only component, but I suspect they're very much in the minority. So my personal view as a taxpayer is that we should be looking to provide people with a reasonable standard of living using the age pension as part of that, and for a very few people possibly supplemented in order to get them to that standard. The other point I want to make is that I was interested in your five pillars that the World Bank came up with. I don't know what those other two pillars are, but I was going to make the comment after reading the paper that there is a significant source of money for people in retirement that isn't mentioned, or it's buried in the private accumulation of wealth, and that's inheritance. Now, the baby boomers are now at an age where their parents are dropping off the perch. Many of them are inheriting significant amounts of money. It might be a house or a, you know, a half or a third of a house, but there's significant amounts of money, all of which is available to support them in their retirement. Again, as a taxpayer, I don't feel any obligation whatsoever to support the inheritance of the next generation. So that money should be available before those people draw on the public purse in order to support them in retirement, as should their own home.
That's a very good point. Well, I think one more point before we move on.
Grab it in time. Anthony Asher. Read an interesting paper recently trying to distinguish between the purpose of Social Security, big debate internationally between what they call rights-based and needs-based, which we've dealt with in a sense. The guy, I'm afraid I forgot his name for the second time tonight, but he's Loughlin somewhere or another from the Brooks Institute. You can Google him if you like. But he talks about risk-based, and I think that's quite a useful additional perspective to look at. To come from is to say that, in fact, the Social Security is there to make up for people that have been unlucky, and I think that's it's a useful focus and is not really in that list. Well, yeah. So 80 billion Social Security.
700 billion. Okay, I'll hand over to Jeff for. Yes, wondered if there's any more comments about what people view as a possible future purpose of the age pension. Is the purpose changing over time?
I think clearly it's gone from the alleviation of poverty to something
better
than that. Yeah. Hi, Melinda Howes. I think that at the moment it is a necessary part of the retirement income structure, but perhaps in the future as we get people who've had compulsory superannuation through their whole working lifetime move into retirement, it maybe then can be looked at as becoming more of a safety net for the alleviation of poverty. At the moment there's a vast proportion of people do get the age pension, 75% or something of retirees are getting it. And if you look at how much it makes up, it's a significant proportion of even fairly well-off people's income. So I think it is, at the moment, a very necessary part, but perhaps in future, as people self-fund more and more, it could change.
Okay. Thanks for those comments. I think they're very interesting, and we'll move on to the next part. And I'll hand over to Jeff.
Okay, well, Appendix C, we look at the scorecard. Is the age pension achieving its purpose? And as we've suggested, the purpose at the moment for many people, of course, is the alleviation of poverty. I mean, certainly that's the way Centrelink see it anyway. So we need to look at poverty measures in order to make some judgment. We did in fact do that. The Henderson poverty line is the one that is most frequently referred to in the media. So we went through that quite carefully. It's quite a good measure in the sense that it's updated every 3 months. Unfortunately, in the paper it's about a year old, but the analysis process is non-trivial, and so to do it all again just because we were a few months out didn't seem to be worthwhile, so my apologies for that. But however, we did find that on the measures in relation to age pensioners, or the ones that seemed most suitable for the age pensioners, the age pension actually beats the poverty line in all respects. And indeed, if you add on all the concessions and allowances and things like that that most age pensioners get, then I wouldn't say they're comfortably off, but certainly they're better off than one might have anticipated from all the calls within the media at the moment, that everybody's poverty stricken and everybody is living in squalor. The one area where we found that there probably was significant inadequacy was in the area of rent assistance. Not of that, those who privately rent. The rent assistance is quite pathetic. $50 a week or something like that is the maximum you can get, and then only if you qualify in a whole range of ways. And so we feel that's one area that in fact really does need some attention. But as far as the basic pension is concerned, and the non-housing needs it's intended to cover, then it did seem to be reasonable in relation to the Henderson poverty line and also a few of the other poverty lines that have been developed as well. Then the another area which we thought we ought to look at, at least look for comments on, was the relationship between couples and singles. Again, there's been talk in the paper about the relationship not being the way some people would want it. At the same time, of course, there is the argument that says, well, why should a married couple be worse off than two sisters that happen to live together, and that sort of argument. So we'd be interested in your views on that particular aspect as well. Our questionnaire actually asks the question in a way that perhaps you might not have expected, but you don't need too much mathematics to work out what we're actually getting at. And then of course we're looking at the age pension as part of the retirement incomes for most people these days, and the question is it really pulling its weight? But again, one of the big problem of course is lack of integration, where we've got a pension which is increasing in line with inflation and a lump sum which is invested half of it in shares. So we're not really quite, it's very difficult to actually work out how it all it gets put together. I mean, we have to try, of course, but it certainly does make things difficult not having a properly integrated system, which we would like to actually see some progress made on. Anyway, any comments on the question of how well the age pension is fulfilling its purpose?
Anthony Ash again. Great discussion of Henderson. There are lots of different ways of measuring poverty, and we really, I think, should look at some of them in Australia. South Africa's marketing association, which is funded by a levy on all advertising, done some brilliant work in this area. They've got what they produce is a living standards measure, which looks at useful things like, do you have a fridge? And how many cars in the house, and that. So the correlation between living standards and income is positive, but not that high. It's pretty meaningless, in fact, to look at one number that is meant to fund people in completely different circumstances throughout the country. And I think there's a lot to be said for pressurizing government into doing alternative measures of poverty and welfare, so that the benefits can actually be targeted to people who need it, rather than spread around on the assumption that money is the only measure, only thing that can buy standard living. And I think you're absolutely right, particularly that the biggest difference, I'm sure, will be housing. But I mean, housing costs vary from 20 to 50% of people's income around the place at the moment. And this is not widely understood by policymakers who bought their houses some time ago. And we need to say it quite frequently.
We wholeheartedly with everything you said there, Anthony, but it is worthwhile noting that the as far as pensions are concerned, there's only a relatively small number of people who actually rent privately. There are a number that are in public housing, there are a number that are in retirement homes and so on, but the number that actually privately rents is small, and unfortunately I think they've been ignored.
Exactly.
Ross Clare. I've also had a bit of a look at the incidence of poverty amongst the aged, and I'm not sure I'd be quite as confident that it isn't too much of a problem there. there's different ways of looking at it, but basically the single age pensioners in particular, and quite a large proportion of the age population in Australia, they're on incomes which are just above whatever poverty lines are commonly used. So, and it comes from the way the system's designed. The 25% of average weekly earnings actually, when you work back, is very similar to the way the poverty lines are set in terms of the distribution. So we have a lot of people just marginally above the poverty line. You know, 14 grand a year for a single age pensioner, people can manage on that if they're home earners, but it's a pretty austere lifestyle, I think, is a fair description. So I think that perceptions that are in the community about the paucity of the age pension do have a fair basis in fact, particularly for the single. Poverty researchers use equivalence rates, which are a bit different to those that are used in our social security system. Couples on the age pension can manage a bit better, and when you have a look at the how they compare to poverty lines and expenditure needs, they're a bit ahead of the singles, and particularly ahead of the singles in private rental. On the deprivation point, it's something that the government does look at, and I'm actually on the fringes of the review of the age pension and carers pension, so they are looking at quite a range of measures of poverty and deprivation, and I think rightly so. Not many, you know, we've had the question asked of quite a few politicians lately, can you live on $14,000 a year, or that amount of spending, and I think for us in this room and for a lot of the current non-retired population, that's a very big ask. And it's not just the baby boomers who are carrying on. A lot of the people who are really poor and on low incomes, you wouldn't call baby boomers. They're in their 80s and 90s, and their particular problem cases. They're not in the workforce. They're never going to get any extra savings. Their parents are long dead. And even for the baby boomers, the NatSEN work shows that lots of people aren't going to benefit much from inheritance. A lot of their parents are actually relatively poor. If you have housing in places other than Sydney or Melbourne, it may not be worth that much, particularly when it's split between you know, three or four children, and the families used to be bigger. So a little bit of a range of comments, but I think we do have some real challenges ahead in terms of adequacy of retired incomes, and the age pension alleviates poverty, but just it just gets people just over the line, particularly single-age pensioners.
Yep, well, we certainly agree with that, and thanks for mentioning all those angles. I mean, in some ways we'd like to have expanded the work we were doing in relation to pensions to carers and the disabled. And there's certainly a lot of problems in there, those areas. In fact, how we believe, if anything, they're the greater problems than the straight-age pensioners. But however, unfortunately, I don't really know there's much more that the government can do at the outset. It's just they've got to have one number, one size fits all, and then hope that all the concessions and allowances and medical support and Centrelink advice can take people through. Further comments?
Yeah, Zach Roberts. I was looking through the Retirement Incomes Task Force today, and I'm not going to claim to be an expert in this at all, but I think they refer to the single age pension as being well below the poverty line. I'm not sure what measure they were using, but I think it's 14,000 compared to about 18,000 for the poverty line, which equated to needing to spend only about $60 a week on groceries to get by on the pension.
I remember seeing something like that in their submission. I remember I actually maybe even made a comment on it, but I forgot what the comment was now. Did they use the Westpac? You know, I think the thing is they use the Westpac modest standard of living rather than... Sorry about that. Anyway. Yes.
No, they used that, but they also did use a poverty measure as well.
All right, okay. That's not a poverty measure, that's a lifestyle measure. That is, but I think Zach's saying that there might be a slight disagreement between the Institute submission and the Dunstan Wickham submission. No. But they did both.
They did both measures, and you're right. I think from memory it was $66 a week on food, $12 on something, and $73 on transport. So I thought those pensioners are getting around a lot.
Yes. Anyway,
please. There was a survey put out yesterday that I think was saying some pensioner group, some pensioner demographics are spending a third of their money on poker machines.
I don't know about the poker machines, it's Jeff Burgess again. But the relationship between the single pension and the couple's pension, now that we've got same-sex marriages, will those people only get the couple's rate?
I don't know the answer to that one. As opposed to Jeff and his wife.
You have to be a legally married heterosexual couple, or is there a sort of cohabitation type test for the couple's pension? So if you're found in the same bedroom or something or other, then you get charged for it.
My experience with Centrelink
is that's a spot where they do recognise all sorts of relationships if they can cut money for. Yeah, that's right.
Can I just add that the Attorney General says there's only one sort of marriage in Australia, heterosexual. The law says. So all those other choices can come under de facto, but not as a marriage.
But does that mean you are a de facto couple, you get the lower rate?
We think so.
I don't know enough.
Anyway, I might hand over to Darren now for the next section.
Thanks, Jeff. I've got the stopwatch to keep the to make sure I get through it all. So the next slide is about other issues. So why are we suggesting reform of the age pension? And one reason, as Jeff suggested, is that maybe the age pension is not actually achieving its purpose. Certainly one reason for the reform is that the projected cost is due to increase, as Jeff mentioned earlier. But nevertheless, the actual increase in the cost is actually quite small compared to the increase in health costs, and in particular the increase in the pharmaceutical benefits scheme, I think. So what are your views on this? Is this future increase in expense as a percentage of GDP, is it sustainable? Another reason we think for reforming the age pension is the means test. And when we started this process of writing the paper, we sat down with a blank piece of paper and tried to write down all the things that we thought would change the world and fix the age pension. What are the problems of the age pension? And 90% of those problems related to the income and assets test. So our paper discusses a number of these problems, which include the disincentive to work and save, the high effective marginal tax rates, the disincentive to invest sensibly, the encouragement for double dipping, the complexities and inconsistencies in the indexation arrangements and benefit payments, not to mention the invasion of privacy, and all of those things are means test related. So I'm interested in your views. Are they a problem? Do you agree that they're problems? Are they a necessary evil? Finally, we now have a compulsory superannuation system. So the superannuation system, the second and third pillars of our retirement system, were built 90 years after the initial pillar, the age pension, was built. And in my view, it looks like an ad hoc extension to the Acropolis rather than a thought-out, carefully integrated support of the roof. And our paper shows that the outcomes of a mature SG system might actually be adequate for some people, but not for others. It really does depend on demographics. And it's hard to reform the age pension without considering changes to compulsory superannuation. We have a retirement income system. So what, if anything, needs to be done in that space? And so I'll throw it over to you. What are the priorities for reforming the age pension? Where do you think it needs to change?
Pauline Durand, I just wanted to talk about the means test, in particular the assets test, because, of course, most people's major asset is excluded from the assets test, and that seems to me to be a bit of a problem. And I think it's highlighted by something which I think must be quite a recent development. I understand from Centrelink that if you are entitled to a part pension, they will arrange for you, if you like, to have the full pension and essentially have a secured loan, and essentially it's usually your house. So Centrelink themselves actually allow you to make that arrangement. Now, you know, that seems to me a bit unfair because, you know, if you do have, you know, a very expensive home and not many more assets, you have the full pension. If you have a fairly modest home but other assets, then you might be entitled to a part pension, and Centrelink would essentially have a loan against your home. I wonder, I mean, in a way that works a little bit like the HECS education system, you know, if you've got the money, you pay it back. I wonder if there's an avenue of actually making the whole pension essentially a HECS system, so when you die, it's retrieved from your estate, if that's possible, because you have such a huge asset in your home generally, and I imagine that that would go down like a lead balloon in any political. but it does seem to me to be a fair thing, because if you do have no money left at the end, then no one's going to be asking you for it.
I think it's an interesting point, and I know that Michael Rice, I think, has suggested a similar thing in the past. And Anthony made an excellent comment at the Age Pension Super Forum a few weeks ago now, that a person's home at retirement is, you know, between 8 and 10 times their final salary. Superannuation, if people are lucky, is about 3 times final average salary. So the home is actually a very important part of retirement savings. And the fact that the assets test exempts homes produces all sorts of weird and wonderful things. If you downsize your home, and then, which many retirees want to do, then you bring your equity from your home into the assets testing. So you're actually worse off from quite a legitimate retirement strategy for using your home. It's an interesting point. Any other comments?
Anthony Ash again. I mean, I think it's a brilliant idea, and as you say, we can't. It's very nice to be generous to everyone, but I mean, I think we should encourage this government as much as possible, because it does appear to be, when they're looking about the architecture of the Henry Review is the architecture of the tax system and the social security system, really is an opportunity to address fundamental issues, and this is a fundamental question, and it's outrageous. That the system works against poor people, and the means test is a system that works heavily against them. I've called it an administrative atrocity. It is. Centrelink is not capable of and cannot be capable of making the assessments that it's meant to do, and that's very, very clear. ANA, the Australian National Audit Office, went in there, found in the space of 2 months 2 million errors in their files. Now that's not the areas, that doesn't say anything about the extent to which their files represents the true assets and income of the people that they are meant to be administering. That's just looking at the files. So I think it just needs to be said again and again, and that does mean necessarily that we're going to have to find other means of raising cash and getting rid of this means test and Centrelink's administration of it. It is an atrocity.
How do people feel about the projected cost of the age pension? Is this an issue that we need to deal with? A big no from Philip. This is your view.
Speaking as a non-actuary, I say no. Speaking as somebody who'd be long dead by
the No, that's not necessarily true.
I plan to be around for a lot longer than that, just to spite my family. But, you know, but no, I don't see that as an issue because as one of the world's most affluent countries, it keeps getting more affluent. Why should that be an issue? The Europeans seem to be able to proceed quite happily on the basis of funding people in a decent retirement. That's their underlying philosophy. Seems like a good one to me. And there's always going to be some anomalies. On this pension question generally and its affordability, though, I do think one issue, and again, this is anecdotal to some extent, is the de facto age pension of the disability pension. I, being a leading edge baby boomer, have lots of friends in their 80s and 90s who have been liquidating their homes and trading down for years and years, and they're quite happy on their pension. They've got a home, they get a cash injection every now and then when they go from a three-bedroom house to a one-bedroom apartment to a nursing home or whatever. They're fine. They're the frugals. These are the frugals. But I've also got lots of friends on disability, guys who were once professionals who, for various reasons, alcoholism or whatever, are on disability. Disability pension is not enough to fund the lifestyle of a 60-year-old or a 55-year-old. That's an issue when there's so many more of them on that de facto age pension. I think that's a cost issue going forward.
One statistic we noted in the paper is that 20%, I think it's about 23%, of all Australian males between the age of 60 and 64 are on the disability support pension. 23% of the population. Now that is, it doesn't feel right.
They're all my mates.
Well, that's right. But and I think that points to an integration problem with unemployment benefits. I personally can't see why we are more harshly penalising unemployed people. The rate of the pension, if it was raised to disability levels, I think would have an impact on those statistics. It just doesn't seem to be any employment incentive. I know I can understand why it is a bit low, but it just doesn't seem to work anymore.
I agree with Philip that we can afford the higher proportion of GDP for pensions, and the system will be somewhat self-correcting. There's plenty of scope for the participation rate to increase in the Australian workforce, and you make the comment in the paper, and it's made in many other places, that our participation rates are significantly below the participation rates in otherwise equivalent economies around the world. So there is scope for us to improve the participation rate. That has a double effect. It takes people off a pension, earning an income, and of course they're paying more tax. So you've got more people paying for less people in retirement. The second point is that there are countries already financing the levels that have been projected for Australia in terms of the cost of retirement incomes or age pension. And they haven't fallen over yet, and I'm sure we can afford it. A bigger problem is likely to be the health costs rather than just the pension costs, because they're going up much faster than inflation, and the demographics are against us. And I don't think anybody's yet got to the point where they've had to deal with that.
Okay, well, thanks for that. I'll now hand you over to Jeff to start talking about some of the reform ideas that we've got on the paper.
Yes, it was a good lead in there, Jeff. Increase workforce participation. I have a feeling that your comment about not being too worried about the increasing costs was provided that we can increase workforce participation. And there really, in many ways, that's the major issue. I think there are still people around who look upon 55 as a good age to aim for retirement. I mean, that's when you get your superannuation. Let's see what we can do about you know, retiring then. Now, obviously, most people, when they get to that age, they suddenly realise that maybe they can't retire at that age, but there's still a bit of a focus on that. I actually have got one of my children actually thinks that's a good target to go for. Now, well, okay, good luck to him if he can make it, but I don't think he will. Anyway, but the main thing is, I think what we'd like to discuss now is the methods, perhaps, that might be used, the financial methods that might be used to encourage workforce participation. I mean, the government's doing a lot of work through committees, business groups and so on, to encourage workforce participation in a whole range of different ways, but I'm looking here solely at the people who are over age 65. How can we get more of them to continue to work? Pension bonus scheme, is that how much effect is that having? Do people know? Do people feel? Could it be improved? The suggestion we've made is employment earnings. Let's exempt them from the means test. We suspect that quite a lot of people are already earning money from employment and collecting the age pension and not declaring those earnings, because the problem being that the means test is a greater disincentive than the tax. The tax is quite low for a lot of people, but the means test is quite vicious when it takes 40% of whatever you earn away from you. We feel, though, that okay, it will cost government money, but we feel that the economic benefit derived will more than outweigh that, plus the social benefit as well of having people working. And perhaps the last thing that gets raised from time to time in a number of different areas and is already going on in other parts of the world, increase the minimum age at which we pay the age pension. The issue is, do we? If we do, we believe that that is the way that it needs to be done in order to control the costs in the future, and indeed for that matter to make sense, if you like, of a reasonable balance between working and retirement. How would it be done? Because one can imagine that would not be a popular decision amongst the particular people who might be directly affected. Certainly if you said that you know, today that people currently aged 64 will have to wait 5 years to get their pension instead of the 6 months they were looking forward to, they might be understandably upset. On the other hand, if the change from 65 to 66 didn't happen for another 15 years, then you go back and work out who's affected by that, and you find it's somebody who's perhaps around about 50 years old at the moment, and they may shrug their shoulders and say, well, there's a long way off, wouldn't matter quite so much. So there's sort of, there is a political considerations with the implementation of this. Anyway, we put a few notes in Appendix G on some of these things, and just be interested in your views. Maybe you have other thoughts.
John Duravin. I can't imagine that the pension bonus scheme as it stands at present is going to encourage very many people to defer retirement, but the reason there is that it's so unattractive. But I mean, I can think of some of the pension schemes which I worked on back in the days of the Government Actuary's Office, where you're offered a fair bit of flexibility about your retirement date, but the basically you received whenever you chose to retire effectively an actuarial equivalent pension to, you know, if you had retired at the earliest available date. So is that, you know, a possible piece in the solution, piece of the jigsaw in the solution? Because, you know, if we're going to do something like that, it would mean, for example, that the absolute basic rate of the age pension, you know, perhaps could be allowed, or you, putting it another way, you might not feel an urgent need to increase the minimum base rate of the age pension if you offered much more significant uplift factors for people who chose to work later. Mm. And that would then be a very you know, material incentive to people. They could see very clearly the impact on their living standard of, you know, working an extra 1, 2, 3, 5 years.
Yep, it's a thought. The Retirement Incomes Task Force, I think their proposals include a scheme for increasing, having a higher pension if you take it later.
Yeah, it does, and I think they also mentioned that there's a fair few countries that already have such a system in place, including Germany, US, Canada, and some other big ones.
It's one that we didn't go into any great depth, I suppose partly because we did a lot of other things, but one of the considerations is to what extent is the age pension an entitlement as opposed to an alleviation of poverty welfare point. And the other thing is the complexity involved in means testing. Either you means test at age 65 or you means test later when you pick up the age pension. How does it all fit together? There are quite a lot of complications, and so we decided to get on this. We just simply talked about, you know, obviously improving the pension bonus scheme in some way or other could well be a way in which we could go.
Thanks. I think Anthony Ashok, the Henry review, not the Henry, the other one review says that they took their researchers 2 years to work out the complexity of the social security system in Australia. That's people with full access to all the necessary administration. So on the grounds of complexity, I would say take out the pensions bonus, abolish the pension bonus scheme. It's only fiddling at the edges. What I would add in its place is physiotherapy. Most of the 23% of people over 60 who are not working have backache. And that's not because they, and I repeat a comment that from a doctor who's involved in these things, that it is the diagnosis and not the condition that causes the claim. We need to reframe the question. You are not, just because you have backache or because you have some age problems, you're not unfit for work. We need to get people back to work and free of defining themselves as pensioners. And I think that's the major way of raising the retirement age, make people realize that they actually still can be active and contributing.
I think there's elements of society that might define them as pensioners as well and not give them a job, but anyway.
I think there are a lot of people who lost their jobs at a time when manufacturing industry in Australia was opened up to competition, who will never get another job. And many of those are well and truly under 65. They're not going to go back into the workforce when they get to 65. So you've got an existing significant problem that you've got to deal with, and you're not going to solve that problem by increasing the participation rate of that group of people. So I was going to make one other comment that occurred to me. The idea of exempting personal exertion income from the means test fits quite neatly with the bonus pension scheme for retiring later, so that you're not actually taking into account the income people are earning after age 65 to, let's say, 68 or whatever it may be that they start to draw the pension, other than the fact that it may have augmented the assets that they've got.
Yeah. Well, one of the beautiful things about exempting salary from the income test is, first of all, it doesn't cost very much. It costs about $1 billion out of total age pension cost of $24 billion. To put that in context, Brendan Nelson, $30 a week, costs about $1.5 billion. So it's actually quite cheap, and the more successful it is, it actually doesn't increase the costs at all. It still stays at about $1 billion. So that has huge economic positives and multiplier effects from people actually contributing productively.
Yes. The focus here, rather than Jeff's manufacturing workers who aren't working when they reach 65 and therefore you can't expect them to work, it's people who are currently working and are currently targeting 65 to get out of work. We want them, we want to encourage them to continue to work if they have a job that they can enjoy and participate in and so on. That's the focus. At the moment there is a mindset that says 65 is it.
Mike Barker. I find this interesting, but I wouldn't get too carried away over the idea that people will change their retirement date for through financial incentives. I think we're seeing more and more behavioural research that says that the human being is not a single period wealth maximiser or whatever the textbooks say. And I think a lot of people who go on working go on because they enjoy working, because it makes them feel important, because they get some, what Maslow would call self-actualization out of it. You know, I certainly put myself in that category, and I hope I can go on working until I'm 75, but it's not for the money. It's because I like peer recognition, etc. And I think the evidence for that is also the number of retired people who work for charities and don't earn any income at all. So I just wouldn't get too carried away in thinking that changing these formulae will actually make much difference.
Then it won't cost much, then, will it?
Just as the mic's going too, another issue, Jeff, always makes me think of this, that the way we change things in this country every couple of years, I don't know if I'd be putting off my retirement on the promise I was going to get some extra amount for the next 40 years of my life, on the grounds that it'll probably all be changed 2 years after that anyway, so.
How cynical. one more comment.
All right. The military has a very nice way of encouraging people to stay. Money and superannuation and training. And some stay and some go because they've had enough after 20 years. And school teachers have the same incentive plan too. 57, you can retire, or if you stay longer, we double your contribution to superannuation without you being. And there are people who want that.
Mm. That's good.
Okay, thank you for that. So next, the paper contains a raft of ideas to reduce the future budget impact. And I should say that we've produced a lot of different ideas, not all of which we're terribly enthusiastic about, but we thought we'd put them out there for discussion and government may be interested. Increasing compulsory SG contributions will decrease age expenditure through the operation primarily of the assets test in the future. So, is this a good idea? Should the level of compulsory contributions or soft compulsion be introduced? On the other hand, should we have measures to reduce double dipping? And there's a few options discussed in the papers. Compulsory annuitisation, annuitisation through tax incentives perhaps, or tax penalties for large withdrawals above certain limits. And better super, I know we've moved away from that, but nevertheless we think it's an important issue. On the other hand, should we tighten the means test in the future? And certainly this goes against the recent trends of liberating the means test and reducing taper rates increasing thresholds, but that might be a measure used to contain future costs. Alternatively, should we require that all super above a certain level, perhaps the assets test, be fully utilised before you're eligible for the age pension? In other words, use up your super first, then go on the age pension. And you could build incentives in that scheme to perhaps take out some form of annuity. That actually might encourage double dipping, it might speed it up. That incentive is there at the moment. In some ways that proposal is similar to simply increasing the age pension because you're deferring the point at which people are eligible. So a few ideas there. Interested in your thoughts? And certainly while we're waiting, if you do have your pen with you, if you can start circling things in your paper.
Ross Clare again. In terms of the notion of reducing the level of double dipping, I think it's an interesting sort of concept that one of the problems in that approach is that we don't have very much double dipping at the moment. People either don't have very much money, so they don't have it to dissipate, and those with a lot of money tend to hang on to it quite well and have investment plans and draw it down over time and do the right sort of things. The anecdotal accounts of people blowing all their savings so they can live a life of luxury on $14,000 a year don't ring very true to me, and when people have tried to go out and find them in surveys and other ways, they haven't been found. So I think you have to be a bit careful in addressing a problem that doesn't really exist. And some of your solutions can be worse than the problem, because when you tighten means tests, we might be getting back to the old situation where there are 100% effective marginal tax rates on savings over certain quite significant bounds. The fairly recent reforms to the income and asset tests have actually led to more reasonable taper rates, and you know, they're still quite high compared to tax rates in the personal income tax system. So I just urge some caution, both in terms of the perceived problem and what's being addressed, and what the solutions and their side effects might be. There are real dangers in any system in focusing it and having fairly tight means tests. The same goes with the dissipation of personal assets to be used before claiming the age pension. It isn't much of an incentive for voluntary saving, if you know that that's the consequence. So it may affect some behaviours in a desirable way, but some other behaviours, the effects might be quite undesirable.
Thanks, Ross. And certainly I think from the work you've done, it shows that the median balances are still quite low. And I think the annuitisation double dipping issue, I think you're right, it's probably more a problem for the future when the average balance perhaps increases to, from I think retirement balances 130,000 to 140,000 to more like 300,000. I guess that's when you start raising questions about should that tax concessional lump sum then be required to have an annuity. The side issue is whether or not the explosion of people having large debts shortly or during retirement, whether that's because they use superannuation as a vehicle just to pay off their housing debt. If there was some restriction on what you can do with your lump sum, perhaps people might think more carefully about their debts. So that there's another economic argument there.
I'd just like to put my HEX lookalike suggestion under other, because essentially it would be quite attractive in that you could choose what level of pension you had up to whatever the maximum was on the basis that you would pay it back at the end, rather than be assessed up front with your major asset excluded. So essentially the government would get your house at the end.
Any other comments or questions?
Yeah, I've got one small one, Darren. Just on the issue, I think increasing compulsory contributions is a good idea, but there is a hazard there, I think, and that is if you make people contribute to something, I believe you probably also create an expectation, especially as you increase the amount, that the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow will be quite a substantial one. For most of my working life, was forced to contribute to super. They just took it. I didn't have a choice. But there was a guaranteed defined benefit at the end of it, so that's a fair deal as far as I'm concerned. But compulsory contributions going up to, say, 15%, where you're on your own, you get the money and you're on your own, I see some problems with that possibly down the track a bit. I pose that as a question more than as an assertion.
We should start by stop calling it the superannuation guarantee.
Okay, one last question before.
Just a comment on the HEX idea. You can already, if you like, take out a reverse mortgage and live off your home. So I'm not sure we need to get the government to do what markets are already providing. The main comment I want to make is I'd be very careful about looking at anything to do with compulsory annuitisation, because as long as the underlying fundamentals of an annuity are that it's a fixed income investment, it's absolutely inappropriate for people with sort of a 20-25 year investment horizon. So to force people to do that, I think should really be thought about before it's implemented.
Well, I might clarify my comment. I've used the word annuitisation, and that's commonly used to think about a lifetime indexed annuity, but it could equally apply to some form of market account-based pension with restrictions. Okay, I'll hand over to Jeff to talk about some other options.
Okay, well, the next section I'll talk about is Appendix F, which talks about simplification. See if we can simplify the system. And the first suggestion we've got is, can we move to a single means test instead of having a dual means test, which has a range of difficulties with it, or with them, if you like. And the one we've suggested here is that we take all the assets except the home and lifetime pensions. We deem them to earn income at a prescribed rate. In other words, an extension of what we currently have as a deeming to determine income for the purpose of the income test. In other words, take all assets, exclude the house and lifetime annuities, deem them to earn income at a certain rate as prescribed, and then add back the lifetime annuities if anybody has to have one. And that then is your income for the purposes of the means test, and then everything that applies from then on. Another simplification was really, in many ways, it's not really a simplification, it's just a sensible approach, we feel, that with means test thresholds, and the allowances and concessions, all of those, let's have them just automatically indexed in line with the age pension, rather than mucking around each year with them for political purposes and manipulation and so on. Another suggestion we have is the amount of tax we actually levy on the age pension, or the age pension component of people's retirement income, really is quite low. We reckon perhaps no more than about $500 million is collected in terms of tax on the bits and pieces that everybody gets as pension or part pension. So why not exempt the age pension from taxation? Lines it up consistently then with the pensions paid from private funds, and one would have thought an attractive measure on a political basis. And the final thing, which I've got on my list here, but there's probably one or two more things in the paper, but just for the purpose of discussion right now, there's a whole lot of supplementary cash payments. Before I started this exercise, I had no idea but how many there were, but there are quite a lot of them. Some paid by the federal government, some paid by state governments. But certainly those which are purely cash and are not in fact means tested, or not, you don't even have to produce bills for, the so-called utilities allowance, the pharmaceutical benefit allowance, and the pensioner's bonus, all add up to $1,500 or something like that, $1,000, $1,200, something like that. Why not incorporate them all in the age pension? Apart from the simplicity and getting and the pensioners getting the money every fortnight, it might also be considered as a way of means testing those payments as well, because arguably somebody who's on a dollar a week of age pension, they really need the same level of allowances as the people who are getting a full age pension. Might be worthwhile increasing the pension, those allowances, and then means setting them down for the better off people. Anyway, over to you. What do you think? Any thoughts?
I recently had to take over one of your financial affairs of my elderly aunt and became aware of the complications of the tax scale of someone who's got a partial age pension and a superannuation pension and all the different allowances and the senior offset and the age pension offset, and I think it just needs to be totally simplified and maybe not exclude the age pension, but maybe have just a higher overall threshold for people over a certain, or who are retired. Yeah, it's a bit hard to define what age you then come into all sorts of questions about whether it should be 65 or 55 or whatever, and whether they're retired or not. But I think the whole tax system needs to be simplified, basically.
That's good. Any other thoughts?
My main thing is to take it away from Centrelink, give it to the tax office, and let them decide on what to, on how to approach it. And then they at least know how to collect income. Centrelink hasn't a clue. So I think that's the thing, the one thing. And then I agree entirely, just abolish the extra cash payments, abolish the senior deduction, abolish everything, and then start from scratch. It's just far too complicated.
How much does Centrelink cost a year to run?
The UK found that for means tested portion of their pension cost £50 a year to run, £5 a year for a non-means tested pension.
Yeah, means testing is not as extensive as ours, though. Anyway, whatever age pensioners cost Centrelink, I think the disability people and the carers and the family tax benefit people all in fact cause them a lot more trouble in total. Any other questions? Any other comments? Nobody thinks the system needs to be simplified? Okay, right then, on that basis, move on to the next section then. Just okay, this is a little bit more of a radical one. As mentioned before, we think the main reason the age pension is not meeting its purpose as a part of retirement income is because of the means test. It does cause most of the problems. So one solution is to just abolish them, take Anthony's idea and abolish everything. Australians accept the universal provision of medical benefits through Medicare. James Packer can go to the local hospital and go in as a Medicare patient. And Australians accept that, and I think that's mainly because it's perceived as fair, because it's funded through an equitable tax arrangement. So I actually think that Australians would politically accept a universal pension. So what this proposal is talking about is to abolish the income and assets test and meet the cost of doing that. We estimate that to be in the order of about $10.6 billion, so not insubstantial, but meet the cost through tax measures. Now, previous proposals for the age pension, including the Institute's own proposal, the universal pension was funded by quite a complex system of clawing back the extra tax from the same individuals that receive the universal pension. And our proposal, on the other hand, is quite different to the previous proposals, because we're suggesting instead of clawing back the tax from the individuals receiving the pension, let's set up some general tax measures which apply to all taxpayers, perhaps not just pensioners, which would generally be considered equitable. And so that makes the whole thing much simpler. So the tax measures that we've suggested to recoup the $10.6 billion include abolishing the discount on capital gains tax, which arguably we don't think has achieved what was promised in the Ralph tax review of encouraging venture capital and creating more efficient capital markets. I don't think it's arguable, it's a separate debate, but it's abolishing capital gains tax discounts, sorry, the discount on capital gains, would raise about $6 to $7 billion. So arguably it's an equitable thing to do as well. That discount has very much benefited high income earners. Another proposal is to remove the tax exempt status of investment earnings on superannuation pension assets. So it's a bit of a big bang proposal, but we think it improves integration. It's simple, and it can be afforded. So we just need to change the tax system. Any thoughts?
I haven't given a lot of thought to this, but the first thing that
occurs to me is that it makes pumping more money into your own house, which is completely tax exempt, much more relatively much more attractive because you're taxing everything else more than you are currently. And I suspect that that is something that people do already, and they would only do more so. So you have, you know, couples with no kids living in six-bedroom houses.
Sorry, that's not true, because the reason people stay in their houses at the moment is because the means test hits them at 40%. There's no way that 40% on the investment income on the sale of or downgrading of a house. Look, the reason people are in the house at the moment is the means test. You abolish the means test, people would feel free to sell their houses and live off some of the investment income.
Any other thoughts?
But then we'll help downsize houses too.
Okay.
Ross Clare, universal age pension gets floated from time to time, but the politics don't seem to work very well. Giving more money to rich people is a hard political proposition, but even if you do have other ways that you say you're financing it, basically we don't have hypothecation in the, in our tax system. You know, getting rid of CGT discounts or whatever have to be justified in their own right. Whether they're good or bad, I'm not going to say. I haven't really thought about it that carefully. But I think it would be a fairly big task to get the political support for the universal age pension. You have your analogy with the Medicare, and there are people who aren't particularly supportive of Medicare, but the universal age pension has been flirted with in the history of Social Security here, including by previous Labor government, at least for certain age groups, and it wasn't a political success, it was reversed, and I think you would have the same difficulties in pursuing that such a proposal at this stage.
I guess I'm an optimist. I think the political debate can be won, and I think the way to argue it is that I've paid my taxes, I deserve the age pension is one way to do it. So.
Darren, I'm just going to say, I can sort of see something like that working. I just think the transition would be the tricky part, because you'd be taking tax off people, you know, who are doing things now in super, who aren't the ones who are retiring, but then giving the money to people who have retired, you know, in future. So I think to get this, you'd have to actually transition into it probably over 20 years or something, so that the people paying the tax actually got the universal pension, rather than, I think the problem now would be, you'd be taking tax off me to give a benefit to somebody else who's in my economic class, but it's actually a generational issue. Oh no, I think the transition would be a tough thing here.
I would speculate, and I don't know, that a lot of capital gains tax is paid by people over 55, the ones with accumulation of assets.
No.
So in some ways, I think there's an equity, approximately.
Sorry,
but
don't
have
any time.
I'm just going to... One last question, so.
Yeah, I think the point is, Greg, that you should see the tax on things system as a whole. And it's the reason to abolish the means test is it's administratively atrocious. And so this means get rid of three or four different things which make the system simpler. If you want to then put some more tax on the elderly to relieve the young, I'll vote for you, even though I probably will lose out.
Okay, now to wrap up, Jeff, talking about the option of purchasing the age pension. Okay. Another idea in the move, the idea of moving towards elimination of means testing that we have thought of, because we all agree we don't like the means testing, we agree that it's all incredibly administratively difficult and so on. Let's try and reduce at least, and maybe eliminate, but at least let's try and reduce it. As Ross has pointed out,
We have a culture in this country. He didn't use these expressions, but I think what he meant was there's a culture in this country of means testing people who've got sufficient means not to give them welfare. Culture, I think, is one that means that we could at least perhaps get down at, anyway, get down to one means test. In other words, we assess people when they first claim, or when they want to claim the age pension. When they do want to claim the age pension, they may well get the full pension, or they may well get a part pension. If they get a full pension, then they get paid the full pension, and that's it. That's the last we see of them. We obviously have to be a little concerned to make sure that they haven't deliberately deprived themselves of assets, given them all to their children temporarily, and take them back again. Ross has suggested perhaps that doesn't happen quite as much as the media suggests sometimes, but whatever. There needs to be obviously some checks and balances there, but the principle of trying to get away with just one means test and for people who clearly should get the full age pension, I would have thought has as an appeal. The next stage, of course, then is which would help in that situation, is to exempt personal earnings, the employment earnings, from the means test. That makes that one means test approach an easy one. We make the age pension tax-free, as we've suggested before, again, simplicity and helping the process. Then perhaps the more the controversial bit, where if somebody has a part age pension and he's putting his hand out, we start, the government says, well, we'll give you that part age pension if you're prepared to buy the balance, and then we'll give you the full age pension. If the pension is, if the purchase price is a reasonable one, and then one would have thought that may well be a reasonable option to be pursued. Obviously, there'll be some people that may say, well, I don't know whether I'm going to live the next 20 years or so. I don't know that I want to spend all my hard-earned money to die next week and find that I've given it all away effectively to the government. Well, there are two ways to deal with that. One would be capital protection option with the annuity, so that any balance of capital that hasn't been paid out as pension on death again then gets paid, and that would give some comfort to some people who have, you know, would be looking upon that as an issue. The other again is the run down your personal resources before claiming the age pension. In other words, if you are expecting not to live terribly long, well, you know, just live and live it up and don't worry. But that would, so the options would be there. But either way, we end up with one means test and we end up with full age pensions being paid, a much simpler system. No real reason why self-funded retirees couldn't purchase the full age pension if they wanted to after the age pension age. I'm sure that could be built into the system. It might well help the government, of course, because once someone bought their full age pension, well, in that case they will never no longer have to go along cap in hand later on to require it. Ultimately, every retiree who wants or needs the age pension will get a full pension after just one means test, and with the means test not looking at employment earnings. Any thoughts? Stunned.
You know my thoughts already, but I'll just share them with others.
Zach has already written to me on this subject. I think he's worried about the government.
Well, fundamentally, if you look at the economics of what's being proposed, is that the government makes the purchase of the pension at a reasonable rate, which means the discount rate they're using in calculating the pension is higher than the government bond rate. And, you know, they can do that because they're expecting to put the money in the future fund and earn higher than a bond return. But if you break it down into its basics, you're asking the government to borrow at better than the government bond rate, take on an asset liability mismatch position, and, you know, pay out as per, you know, the debt. if the government was happy doing that, they'd just be better off issuing debt at the government bond rate and putting the money in the future fund and turning themselves into a hedge fund, basically.
Two comments, but I'll give a more reasoned reply to Zach. One is I think the amounts of money involved would take a long time to get to any sort of material level. And even then, boy, they will level out anyway as the pensions get paid out. The other comment is that we want to means test people. That's the culture. And the means test people means we want them to pay something to get the balance of the age pension. So it's not really a government funding issue, it's more a case of means testing. Melinda. Ooh.
Melinda Howes, mine's more of a question about how this would work. With the one means test, one of the advantages of regular means testing now, or the ability for someone to go back and be reassessed, is that if their circumstances change, like they've just lost 25% of their private pension assets, they can go and get re-evaluated and their age pension goes up to compensate. Or as they run down over time, their personal assets, their age pension can come up. So how would that work under a one means test system?
Well, we're aiming that once they've asked for the part age pension, they pay $100,000 to buy the rest of the age pension. From that moment on, they've then got the full age pension. That's the end of the matter.
What if they don't buy it in the first place?
Pardon?
What if they don't buy it in the first place?
If they don't buy what?
The age pension. They say, no, I don't need that. But then their money runs out.
Well, at some stage, aren't they going to ask for the age pension, aren't they? I mean, if the money runs out. Well, of course, yes. I mean, if obviously somebody comes along, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
You're saying that they come along, they want to get the part age pension, they don't like the deal though, in which case they walk away. Nothing at that stage. They might come back later and say, look, you know, we've used up all our money now and we need a full age pension. Okay? You've got it. That's the purpose of this. We try to put into the paper the philosophical reasoning behind all of this, but the general idea is to if you like, insulate the government in the future from having to pay out bits and pieces and help people out who were able to help themselves if they only invested in lifetime annuities instead of the XYZ superannuation fund, which has lost half their money. Only. Any other thoughts on the subject?
I guess while the one means test has a lot of appeal in a practical sense, I suppose harking back to the idea of continuous testing, etc., is that at the time that you have the one means test, it would be conceivable that you arrange your affairs, particularly if the family home is still a shelter,
mm-hmm.
around that to maximise your part or full pension.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I can't contemplate necessarily that you would ever be able to bring the family home within the means test, because politically I'm not sure that would ever get up.
I agree with you, but even today we have people extending their home in order to use up money that they might otherwise end up having means tested out. And I have a number of friends in that very category. They have bigger homes now that they're on their own than when they had children living with them.
Well, they just have to rent the rest of their house
about
$50 a week to other pensioners.
Oh, good thought. Anyway, if they do that, we can mean test them. Okay, any other thoughts on... Well, any other thoughts on anything? There was one... there was something that came up, actually. Yes, we didn't get much response. We just got a bit of a shower of hands here. Extending the retirement age for the age pension. I mean, there were some people around the table, I felt, around the room were actually saying, no, we don't need to do that at all. I just wondered, for just the camp of people You know, people say, no, we don't worry about do that, or should we definitely plan to do this, increasing the retirement age?
You've asked
a question. Yes, I know. I just wanted to... I wanted to get some thoughts on the subject. Anybody else? I mean, just getting a yeses and noes isn't much of a discussion.
We had a bit of a discussion on this morning at the ASCA Retirement Outcomes Subcommittee, and one idea that was floated by David Knox, actually, was you can get a similar effect by increasing the age at which you do something tax-free to draw it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's
a good one.
And then people, that sort of saves you money down the track, because people get 65 with more assets. Mm-hmm. Maybe a bit more colourful.
Teresa? Sorry.
I don't know whether we can fiddle with the age when the jobs are not out there.
Yeah.
That's the difficult one. You get to a certain age and the jobs are not there.
Mm.
And physical ability.
Well, physical ability, I'd like to sort of talk about the rundown of personal resources, because some of the cases that I've seen, the partner, spouse, has an accident, stroke, car, whatever, you suddenly need a lot of resources to look after that person, and it's unexpected and you can't plan for it.
That is true.
Accommodation bond, refit the car, refit the house if they're immobilised and in
People can always move if the age pension age moved to 66. It may well be that when they reach 65, they're on a disability support pension, and they would need to continue on that. As I understand, I think the rate for the disability support pension is the same as the age pension, I think. And if it wasn't, it should be. but those people who—it's just a question of the culture. At the moment, there is a culture of, you know, retiring at 65. If you have a culture of retiring at 70, we can still accommodate people who are disabled and can't work and unable to get a job. But at the same time, we can accommodate those people who, you know, the culture's changing. They would like to continue to work, and so on. Anyway, this is just
actually, we have a culture of retiring by age 62 on average, or 57 if you're a teacher. There isn't actually much of a lump of retirement for age pension eligibility age, which is 65 for men, but slightly less than rising for women. Professionals find the idea of abolishing age pension age and things quite attractive. Brickies and carpenters and other people aren't much impressed by it. Labour participation rates for non-professional employees plummet after age 65.
The only thing is, of course, as you know, as the longevity continues and more people live to age 100, maybe the subject will come up again.
I think we're running out of time. I think, Mike, if you could maybe have the last word, and then anybody can stand around afterwards having a beer, having a chat, I think. And the words of Bernard Sell, I think the age 30 is the new 18 as well. I think at this stage, Jim, I'd like to just thank you and Darren for your excellent presentation, a great chat, and well done. And as I said, there are